Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, State Board of Education member Nikki Snyder is asked why she believes she will win the Republican U.S. Senate nomination. Andrea Bightley of the Michigan Retail Association is asked about the practical impact of repealing the Death Star. And Doug Pratt of the Michigan Education Association is asked why the state should be spending more money on K-12 education when pupil count numbers are going down. Now, here's MERS editor Kyle Malin with publisher John Roerink and reporter Samantha Shriver.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. We had Donald Trump in Michigan on Sunday night, and one of the people who was in the front row, or at least in the building to check things out, Nikki Snyder, candidate for the U.S. Senate. She's joining us over Zoom right now. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity. Wasn't necessarily in the front row. There was quite a few rows, though. Very popular event. I would say it was probably more towards the middle, but
There was a lot of people. You were definitely working the crowd, and we'll get to your U.S. Senate campaign in just a minute. But let's first talk about your impression of Donald Trump. I was there as well. I was expecting the former president to, be a little more low-key. I thought maybe after a few years away from it, he wouldn't be as engaged. But he seemed as dialed in and high energy as usual.
Yep. High energy. I think that matches where Republicans in Michigan are at, too. I think that's truly a mirror of where we're really at. We're a swing state, right? We're a purple state here in the state of Michigan. This U.S. Senate seat is going to be an open seat, one of the most competitive seats in the nation. So that kind of energy is definitely matching where we're at. Republicans want to be represented in the state of Michigan.
What did you think about his focus on electric vehicles and then making sure that parents had a voice in decisions and not government telling us what we should be doing with our kids?
So, yeah, two separate things. The focus on electrical vehicles, I think, really was about Goshen, right? The battery plant that we have coming into Michigan. And that is significant. That's going to be an issue we're going to continue to talk about for the next several months throughout this campaign cycle. Michiganders want sovereignty in their state. They want sovereignty in their nation. And so when you bring foreign companies that come and use our tax dollars to set up shop, it doesn't really matter if it's electrical vehicles, batteries, or what type of business you're doing. That is a vested interest that we have together that we need to consider. We have politicians, as a matter of fact, that are running for the U.S. Senate right now here in the state of Michigan that are negotiating these types of things behind closed doors and with NDAs. And so the topic itself is really kind of laser focusing us on how we govern and how important state and national sovereignty is. So that's sort of what I took away from that event and that particular topic and what he had to say about it. Parental rights was the one issue in the room that set people on fire.
Yeah, I caught that as well.
Yeah, I would say more people stood up, clapped, had energy. I mean, parents want the right to raise their children up in the way that they think they should go, not in the way the government thinks they should go.
I would like to switch to this U.S. Senate race that you're running in now. You have a statewide seat now in terms of the State Board of Education. So you're known, although sometimes it's very difficult to move from that slot to a larger stage. How do you parlay your seat now? How do you leverage that to get more attention for your run for the U.S. Senate?
I think you stay focused on the work that it took to acquire that seat, right? That was a lot of relationship building in 2016, a lot of travel around the state, a lot of encouragement for fundraising and bringing the party together and encouraging unity. And I would say 16 was the last election cycle that we saw that happen. And then we saw a lot more division and a lot more conflict since then. What I'm seeing is the same opportunity to lead in that respect, which I did in 16, won the statewide vote with nearly 2 million votes. So whether it's the primary or it's in the general, as it's looking to shape up potentially, I'll be the only contender that has ran and won a statewide race with nearly 2 million votes. And, you know, it's an easy thing to say, hey, that's what I've done. It's all that comes with it, right? The relationship building, making calls, being in touch with people, where they're at, right? It's extremely important in politics right now, and this is something I've experienced at the board table over and over and over again. Are you truly coming to listen? Are you truly coming to have a full conversation? Are you truly coming to sit down and hear what everybody has to say, all the stakeholders? That's what it looks like to represent all of Michigan. And so that is what I will bring again. And I think that's a genuine, authentic thing you can't fake people out on. It's just real.
So as of today, how much money have you raised?
So close to $100,000 is what we're looking at for the end of the quarter. Again, that's something that we'll see June 30th coming in. We are bringing in money from DC and PACs that we are encouraging, especially around women's rights, which is a topic that we're going to continue to see grow. People want to see change in that area. And so you're going to see dollars attached to those messages. It's extremely important that we remember that women's rights mattered then, that still matters now. So fundraising is continuing to pick up and is going to be an area of strength very soon.
So when you say some of these PACs, especially coming in from DC, could you name some of the organizations you've been working most closely with?
You will see that come out on the June 30th FEC report.
Oh, and then I have another fundraising question. I mean, how concerned are you when it comes to attracting donors with the U.S. Senate race both being overshadowed by a competitive presidential race and with a lot of members of Michigan's donor class focusing their attentions on the state house?
So, I mean, they should do that, right? We need balance. Again, this is a swing state. I think Michigan tends to lead the nation in changing conversation because we're a swing state. We like to focus on balance and representation. We're not purely red. We're not purely blue. So the fact that they're focusing on the House is a good thing. I don't have a problem with that. Competing for fundraising dollars is not something that's new for any politician or any campaign race. So that's what we're going to have to do. Nationwide, though, the conversation and the different topics that healthcare, education, everybody around the nation cares about those issues right now, right? So fundraising on those issues is not actually going to be a hard thing to do. What we saw during the pandemic is healthcare and education freedom just gutted. And so picking up the phone and calling people, not just in Michigan, but around the nation, we're on the same page, collectively speaking, in a way that you'll see that in fundraising.
How concerned are you that Alyssa Slotkin is dealing in terms of millions of dollars right now in fundraising?
Not very concerned. I mean, she's already had that fundraising base, right, from serving in the role that she serves now at this point in time. Republicans in Michigan are coming together slowly but surely, and that is going to show up in the dollars.
Give our listeners an update on where you are with the signatures and what you're doing to make sure that you don't get sucked into some kind of signature fraud scheme.
Sure. Well, that was one of the advantages of coming out early, right? So we came out early in state convention, in the last Republican state convention, and we walked away from state convention with signatures from over 60 counties. We now have signatures from 63 counties total and have done nothing but gather thousands of more. So by the end of the year, we hope to have reached the 15,000 signature max without having to even pay for one of them. So that's the result of hard work. Okay. That's what we need to do, just not just as candidates, but as people who serve others. So you're going to see that in the signatures.
One of the roles the U.S. Senate advocate has to do is oversee in terms of our national security, our global position. Are there areas in that realm that you want to focus on if you are elected?
Sovereignty. I'll say sovereignty over and over and over again all day long. A free nation, a free world, is led by the concept of sovereignty. Even with nations that we consider allies, that we support and we defend, the very concept of what we're doing when we do that is your sovereignty, and protecting your sovereignty actually relates to protecting our sovereignty. And I think, again, that's a theme that you see even here in healthcare and education freedom, is individual choice is extremely important. When we don't consider sovereignty on that level from a national defense standpoint, we aren't even starting any of the conversations from a foundation that really is what's going to make sure that everybody is truly living freely.
So has the state Republican Party offered any type of new candidate supports or recruitment opportunities? How has it overall been doing with getting voters engaged early on with this race in itself?
I would really encourage you to reach out to the chair part or the party chair and ask them, but they are just focusing on freedom, just like I am. I think our messaging is going to be very much aligned, and that's part of it. But they really don't have a role in that respect. This is my U.S. Senate campaign that I'm running, and I have to do the work of fundraising it, and I have to do the work of representing it. So that's something I'm going to take seriously.
What do you think about the federal charges that have been laid against President Trump for keeping those documents that allegedly he should have been handing over to the federal government?
You know, I won't comment on him and what his choices that he's made, but I will say that's not something I would do. I'm very cautious about how I handle important information, and always have been. Even as a State Board of Ed member, I've been very cautious about, you know, official communication is official communication. We have FOIA laws for a reason, so that the public can access and consider their government transparent to them. So those things are important to me. That's how I will be a U.S. Senator.
Do you have a favorite in the presidential race? Is there any other candidate that you're looking at?
I do not. One of the ways in which I intend to lead a swing state that has experienced a lot of division on both sides in the coming months is to consider this a decision they have to make. I will not be seeking anyone's endorsement, and I will not be giving my endorsement. One of the things I'll be doing and staying really focused on are the issues of the race: healthcare, education, accountability at a higher level, Title IX, tax relief for parents. Those are things that I'm going to continue to talk about. And if a presidential candidate wants to sit down and focus on those issues and support those issues, I'm happy to have that conversation.
Are you frustrated at all about the fact that folks are looking for other U.S. Senate candidates? They don't like the field that we have right now, and there's an effort to try and recruit somebody who brings a lot of money to the table, for instance, or a lot of big name or a big splash.
I wouldn't say frustrated is the emotion. I feel very indifferent to that respect. Nurses don't bring bags of cash to the table for campaigns. They bring knowledge and understanding and expertise. And I laugh about that because that's the honest truth. And one of the things I say, you know, before a lot of Republican groups is we've spent decades focused on two lanes, right? Business and economy. And that's important. It's obviously very important. But one thing we forget this frequently, is healthcare and education have become two huge systems in our government and in our country. We spend a lot of money in those areas. It's extremely important that when you come to the table and you negotiate from any perspective, that you understand the budget, the economy, and business is going to be impacted by healthcare and education. So if you don't come with that nuanced understanding and knowledge, then you're essentially making decisions or negotiating in a way that isn't actually best for people. So I'm really encouraging Republicans and conservatives and all of Michiganders to carve out a space within that respect of, hey, you've got a nurse here. Sure, she doesn't bring bags of cash to the campaign table, but these are issues that have people on fire. Again, parental rights, healthcare worker choice, individual choice, informed choice in healthcare. All of these things are extremely important. And so if you're used to inhabiting the lanes of business and economy, it's harder for you to speak to those issues. If you support a candidate that can speak to those issues, then there's some negotiation that can happen there.
So how big would your eye roll be if James Craig were to enter the party?
Again, indifferent. One of the things I did in 16 that I feel really strong about doing right now is staying focused. I'm going to stay focused on these issues, and here's why: because it really is what's best for Michiganders. That's what it looks like to represent people. If you get distracted by all the candidates that are coming in or out, or the money that someone has that you don't have yet, then you can't represent those issues very well.
Pundits have suggested that post-Dobbs decision, Republican Party is not sitting in a situation that's going to help them on an electoral basis. How do you react to that? And do you think the Republican Party is handling the abortion issue in the right way?
So this conversation is long. We could probably spend a whole hour on it. I think undoing it at the federal level sent it back to the states, right? And that's just a fact. So what we see is this issue on display in every single state. And Michiganders voted very decisively on Prop 3 and abortion this last cycle, 55 to 45. We now lead the nation from a state perspective. We are the most far left policy that exists, right? You can get an abortion anytime, any reason, for anywhere, essentially, up to the point of birth. So that is a completely different conversation than what other states are having, right? And so I think that as we move forward, we're going to have the conversation where it's actually being had. So I have a lot of people ask me old questions. It's like, those are old questions. That's not where the conversation is. The conversation is here. I would say one of the biggest places that that conversation is, and I would know this firsthand as a labor and delivery nurse, right? I've had three children myself. Each time I had the opportunity to choose life, I did. So I understand what my pro-life identity is, but I also understand the last election cycle and the results of it. However, I also have a bird's eye view of the issue from a very nuanced perspective. So again, the conversation could go an hour long. One of the things that's extremely important to me is healthcare workers having a choice. There's a very popular federally funded, state funded public hospital in the state of Michigan that I know is requiring labor and delivery nurses to sign an attestation form that they will not refuse to taking part in a termination, if you will. So it's things like that where when we say, as a culture, as a society, we value choice. Do we value choice, right? Should we really be saying to labor and delivery nurses, you cannot be a labor and delivery nurse unless you're willing to take part? I would say no. So that is just one small area where this conversation truly is at. And we honestly probably need to have a town hall just on that, or a long discussion on that, so that we can help people come back to the middle on this issue, because it has been very divisive.
Nikki Snyder, do you believe that you will be the Republican nominee for the U.S. Senate?
I do.
And why do you believe that?
Because I do bring to the table representation, knowledge, and leadership on the issues that are at the top of most people's lists right now. I can tell you, I have been calling again around the state, around the nation. And one of the things that I didn't hear in 16 or in 20 is how important healthcare and education really is to people. Representation in those areas, freedom, choice, and liberty in those areas. And it's not just Republicans and conservatives. It's middle of the road, independent voters that swing. And we are a swing state.
All right, Nikki Snyder, she is a member of the Board of Education and a candidate for the U.S. Senate on the Republican side. Appreciate you taking some time and talking with us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Under the sea, darling, it's better down where it's wetter, take it from me. Up on the shore, they work all day, out in the sun, they slave away.
Join us now on the podcast is an old friend of MERS Monday, Andrea Bitely, now with the Michigan Retailers Association. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, even if you just called me old. I'll take it, Kyle. I'll take it.
Hey, if you're old, I'm old, and everybody else is old. I mean, yeah, I mean, you'd rather be an old friend than, I don't know.
Than a new one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because that means you have roots. But you didn't bring any pastries this time, though. Because you're not around right now.
No, I am not in Lansing at the moment.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's okay. But we wanted to have you on because we got this troubling news release this morning about your retail index, and the May 2023 sales were significantly lower than the April numbers. Tell our listeners about this.
Yeah. So the Michigan Retail Index is a 100-point scale. And the Michigan Retailers Association works with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago's Detroit branch to conduct this survey. We talk to our members every month. And in April, we had a pretty positive response. On the 100-point scale, 100 being the best, 0 being the worst, we got a 60. And a 60 means people are buying things, there's optimism in retail. And things are going in the right direction. Last week, we got our response back, working with the Federal Reserve Bank, and they said, we're at 50, which means we dropped by 10 points in a month. That translates to retailers seeing fewer sales, people not being out there and spending money. We're hearing, you know, globally that the recession may or may not happen, or that it may be a lower recession. But Kyle and John, what's the thing about recessions in Michigan? If the nation catches a cold, Michigan gets the flu, right? So we are a little concerned by these numbers because they are not good. We also asked about optimism with our members. And in April, they were fairly optimistic for the next 90 days. They saw a good summer season. They saw tourism going well. Tourism and retail go hand in hand. You know, take a trip up north, you spend money at the local grocery store, the cute little knickknack shop, et cetera. Well, those numbers aren't great. We've gone from having a very optimistic 59% saying positive, which is not good. We're seeing people saying that they're a little nervous is what it comes down to.
I'm curious, Andrea, how much of this do you think has to do with the repeated interest rate hikes by the Fed? How much of it had to do with the month-long run-up to the debt extension that we had going on in the U.S. Capitol? Is it just too cloudy? Is it, what's going on?
You know, the too cloudy aspect is something that we're really looking at. And what our members are really looking at is things that make doing business more difficult. So it's uncertainty. It's people not going out and spending money, but it's also what the legislature is doing for those that keep an eye on that. It's what they're doing in DC. There's a lot of impacts that are very small that actually end up being very challenging for small and mid-sized business.
You know,
people are out there buying stuff, but they're not buying the extra stuff is what it comes down to.
Yeah, I know something observed last year nationally was, you know, while prices have increased, people are still spending as if, you know, these prices are not increasing. Do you think there's an issue right now of Michiganders being really scared to spend their dollars?
It is a nervous time, is what we've really learned from these numbers. When people are out buying those necessities, they're buying, you know, the bread, eggs, and milk. Egg prices are down, by the way. They're all buying those things, but they're not spending, you know, they're not buying the extra pair of shoes. They're not getting the extra toy. Maybe they're not taking as extensive of a trip. They're being cautious with their dollars.
Andrew, what do these numbers usually look like? Is it roller coaster? It goes up, goes down, goes up, goes down. I mean, could just be a blip on the screen?
It could be a blip, but for the most part, we stay pretty steady. We do have some responsiveness to seasonal changes. For example, we usually see jumps in December for shopping because of the, you know, Christmas holiday. But this was alarming to our organization.
Does the survey cover internet shopping as well as bricks and mortar? What's the mix, and do you separate them out?
It does cover both, and we do not separate them out. So this is a survey of our 5,000 members, and we ask all of them the same questions, and we keep all of the information together. We don't separate it out because so many brick and mortars also have online, and some onlines are moving into brick and mortars, so we don't separate things out.
When you think about conversations of your individual members, I mean, which sector of the retailer realm is having the most grievances right now?
Yeah, it's really those smaller retailers that are maybe, I don't call anyone, any retailer optional, but, you know, gift and travel tourism type stores are seeing more of a challenge. Grocery is not seeing as much of a challenge. I just stepped out of our board meeting, and when I announced the numbers, no one seemed surprised. And our board is comprised of members from jewelry to outdoors to grocery, et cetera.
Let's move on to the legislative front. And there are several pieces of legislation I know you all are concerned about. But top on the list is one that we have affectionately called the Death Star. And I only call it Death Star because that's what Progress Michigan called it once upon a time. And I can't think of a better term for it, except I think you are trying to label it something else.
Yeah, we're calling it the Michigan Employment Uncertainty Act. because House Bill 4337 and Senate Bill 171 are really creating a patchwork scheme of mandates for local governments to enforce essentially however they would like.
Death Star seems a little bit more catchy, though.
Yeah, but I don't think anyone consulted Disney about the use of that word. Ooh, and they should probably be concerned. They should be concerned. Disney is a little litigious.
Yeah. And, you know, just to confirm, the big thing with this legislation is that it allows local municipalities to set wage and benefit requirements than higher of those already existing on the state level. You know, and this coalition of opposition is continuously growing, correct?
We are. Every time we try to get the letter printed out to deliver to legislators, we get another inbox, another note in our inbox saying, please add me. We've got a lot of local chambers. You know, we've got the big chambers. We've got the Grand Rapids Chamber, Detroit Regional Chamber. But then we also have Jackson County Chamber, Farmington Chamber. The Chamber of Commerce delegation in this letter is very strong. In this opposition coalition here, what it really comes down to is where things are being regulated. We have a major concern that if we start reducing the level at which things are regulated, it's going to really create a patchwork of regulatory environments across the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. Right now, everything is regulated at the state level, which allows LARA and MIOSHA and all of those state departments that have full-time employees that have this as their job to regulate this, these different processes. And when you are a small or mid-sized business, say you're a convenience store with two locations in two different counties, you have somebody in Genesee County and you have someone in Midland County, those could be extremely different regulatory climates. You have Midland County more conservative, you have Genesee County typically more liberal. You could have a completely different wage and benefit requirement in those two counties. And you have to look at, again, small two-man, two-woman shop. They're probably responsible for running the register, making the orders, making sure payroll gets done, probably being the janitor, so they're cleaning up the bathrooms and they're trying to figure out these complex government regulations at the same time. It's not an easy role to fill.
You know, a question I have is that how does this legislation work when the way that people work is so much different now? You know, you have remote workers, you have, you know, possibly someone living across the state doing a job for that same company that could be in a completely different municipality.
That's a question that we have as well, Sam. You know, where does the regulation fall? If I'm living, you know, in Ingham County, but my employer is based in Wayne County, which regulation am I following? Which minimum wage am I following? Which benefit requirement am I following? And that's why we're all, this coalition is in favor of regulation and the fact that we understand that the state has a role, but we're not in favor of individual small municipalities, of which there's 1,800 across the state of Michigan. So you could have a county, a township, and a city, all trying to step into this regulatory environment that could make things extremely confusing for both employers and for employees.
Are there examples pre-2015, before this policy was adopted, that the coalition is going to use to really highlight the problem?
I can't speak to that right now, John, but okay. I can tell you we are very concerned about the direction of these bills.
Well, because realistically, we're only really talking about Ann Arbor and maybe Detroit. I mean, we're not going to get Piddlywink Township in Alcona County to adopt a minimum wage here.
I don't know about that. I don't know. I mean, what if Muskegon does something? What if Saugatuck does something? What, you know, there's a lot of smaller communities that could do, you know, change the way they're paying folks. It wouldn't surprise me if, you know, Traverse City got involved in setting a different wage or benefit. But we're not really concerned about how much people want to pay their employees that way. You know, there's a state minimum wage and we, you know, believe that what the state of Michigan is setting makes sense statewide. And creating these small jurisdictional changes is a real challenge for employers and employees.
But shouldn't there be some kind of local control? I mean, isn't it their job to be able to set this kind of regulation for their community? Because it could be different. What's going on in Ann Arbor could be different than what's going on in Marquette or Iron Mountain.
Yeah. The city of Ann Arbor is welcome to pay their employees whatever they would like. But we believe that this regulatory environment should be set at a state level. We don't believe that the minimum wage in the city of Ann Arbor should be different than the minimum wage in Scioto Township, for example.
Well, do you have any numbers of companies that have left states that do allow these ordinances to be made?
Yeah, I can't speak directly to that. But what we're talking about right now is creating these high cost islands that would limit community access to jobs and necessities, really limiting businesses that are willing to do work and be open in locations that maybe are 10 to 15% higher than just a few blocks away in some cases.
Well, do you have any members in your own organization that left a state that did have this allowed?
I don't, but that's partially because we are Michigan retailers. So we focus on what goes on here as opposed to other places.
Well, I meant like coming from another state to Michigan and then joining your organization.
I can't really speak to that one, but we're not alone in giving states sole authority. So part of the reason I can't give that is because 44 states have moved to preempt local labor laws since 2013. So a majority of states are regulating all of this at a state level, as opposed to a community or smaller level.
So the formal name, for those people who are listening at home and want to know, this is House Bill 4237, and it is overturning the 2015 Local Government Labor Regulatory Limitation Act. So that's the formal name. Now you know why we've just boiled it down to the Death Star. And as much as I tried to resist adopting the Progress Michigan name, I've just decided to cave in because I don't want to have to repeat that over and over again.
Michigan Unemployment Certainty Act, come on, way better than Death Star, especially when Disney comes calling, and they will. You know they will.
Yeah, if you say so. I don't know. Disney hasn't called yet about the use of the bumper music yet, so I'm not too worried about it. And I'm sure I've used song every once in a while here on this bumper music. I think I have anyway.
Well, not today. Not today, Mr. Malin.
I'll use one today. Actually, hold on. What's your favorite Disney? I'm going to use it as the bumper music coming out of here.
My favorite Disney. Oh, gosh. You got,
like, I like Hi Ho, Hi Ho by the Dwarves.
Sword in the Stone is probably like my favorite Disney movie way back in the old days.
Is there a song or something? Kyle. There's got to be a song or something.
Yeah, there's Yes, there's definitely, there's several songs. There's one that's like fish singing. Yeah.
Hey, Andrea, since you're so old, was that in color?
It was. It was pre-CGI cartoon. Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
No, we got to do
that. There's one that said the song of like to and fro, stop and go. That's what makes the world go round.
All right, I'll find that, and then we'll see if Disney calls for a copyright issue. But I'll keep it under 30 seconds so I can claim some type of...
Oh, yeah, then you're fine.
I should be able, yeah. I'll tell Bayshore, you got to keep this under 30 seconds, Mark. Andrea Bightley.
See if he can do it.
We'll see if he can do it. He's very talented. I'm sure he can. Andrea Bightley with Michigan Retailers Association, thanks for joining us here on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, Doug, we've got kind of a Disney theme going on here from our last interview. So, what is your favorite Disney movie? Let's get that out of the way first.
That's a tough one. I'm a Lion King guy.
Lion King.
I have an outer Pumbaa and an inner Timon, I think that that people have told me I have. So we'll go Lion.
All right, Lion King. So we'll have to use that for the bumper music as we roll out of this. Doug Pratt from the Michigan Education Association. Join us here for this segment of the podcast because, hey, let's be honest, education on the policy front is on the front burner for this legislature. You have to be excited by what you're seeing with the House and the Senate, both moving quickly on these bills that essentially give teachers more rights at the bargaining table, broaden the types of subjects that can be discussed when discussing new contracts.
Yeah, I mean, over a decade ago, these rights were all stripped. And so restoring rights to educators is going to make a big difference in terms of the respect for the profession and the quality of education that we can deliver students, especially when it comes to addressing the educator shortage. You know, we've seen over the course of the last decade, these changes not work in terms of improving student achievement and allowing educators to have a voice in the workplace. We need to fix that, and we're really heartened to see the legislature taking that up. We're hopeful to see this stuff get through this week and really get to a place where we can restore these rights and have it be legal to have these conversations so that educators can have a say in their working conditions, which are the same as students' learning conditions.
Now, administrators are gonna argue here, Doug, that these legislative initiatives are going to hamstring their ability to just run a school district. That they're going to have to run everything by the labor union and through the negotiating table before they can move people around or reprimand somebody who's not doing a good job. They're not going to be able to do their jobs, essentially.
What these bills do is make it legal to have discussions again about these topics, to have transparency, to be able to have a transparent system for how positions are filled. In the end, this is about negotiations. This is about two sides coming together, having a conversation and agreeing on something. Is it changing from the fact that administrators have a unilateral control over these things? Yes. But for 40 years, educators had these rights. They were stripped away under the guise that it was going to make student learning better, and that hasn't worked. We have to go back, restore the respect for educators in the workplace so that we can deal with the educator shortage, which in the end is what's driving a lot of the struggles for administrators across the state.
I'm curious if you could think about it. I want to put you in the hot seat. Is out of these proposals, and there's a number of them right now, including those that have passed, what's the most impactful? Is it the repeal of Right to Work? Is it something else? From the MAA's perspective, what really is the top of your list?
Well, Right to Work, for example, doesn't actually impact public sector employees because of the Supreme Court ruling in the Janus case. So let's take that one and set it aside. I do think restoring rights for people to have a say in their working conditions, to be able to discuss what is a placement system that makes sense, not one that's based solely on seniority. There have been amendments made and changes made to keep us from like bump and bid scenarios where everybody crowds into a gymnasium to figure out what they're going to teach. Nobody wants that. What we want is people to have a say and an understanding in how are decisions made about who's going to teach where, how are decisions made about evaluation systems, how are decisions made and making sure that people have a voice in those processes. So whether it's for teachers and placement, for support staff and being able to negotiate about the impact of privatizing or outsourcing jobs, these are really important things that restore the ability of educators of all stripes to have a say in their workplace so that they can advocate for the education that students deserve.
You know, from the MEA's perspective, I mean, what is considered the dream performance evaluation system that basically makes it so, you know, let's say a global pandemic happens and it doesn't completely flunk a teacher's chances of progressing?
So I think twofold. One is an evaluation system should be developmental, not punitive. We should be using evaluation systems that say, okay, what can you do better to reach your students? And everybody can do better. Everybody has something that they can improve on, and being able to align that with professional development and be able to ensure that educators aren't just being slapped down, oh, your kids did poorly on this test, but making sure that we have a system that helps bring everybody up. I think that's really important, but also local buy-in. An evaluation system really only truly works when the educators in the school district are bought into how this is going to help them improve their practice of helping students. And that's what being able to bargain about this and come to agreements with the school district really does, is create a situation where you can have that buy-in, where you can all get together and say, this is the system we need. These are the professional supports we need to get every student the public education they deserve, no matter who they are, where they live, what background they come from.
As a lobbyist for the MEA, I'm curious, with the first time having a Democratic complete control of state government, you're on the offense clearly now compared to prior sessions. Is it tougher to be on the offense or the defense? And I'm assuming you like the offense better.
Oh, yeah. From a workload standpoint, it's been a long time since we've been this busy. I'll take this kind of busy over the busy of 2011, 2012 any day. So it is vastly different, but it is busy. There's constant conversations going on both sides of the aisle. In the end, education shouldn't be a partisan issue. This is something we should be providing the best education that we have for all of our kids in the state. And I think that's why you're seeing bipartisan support on some things, may hopefully this week, knock on wood, some things in the budget that get bipartisan support relative to improving the funding systems and helping especially to get students who need greater services more funding, more interventions, more support, whether it's an at-risk student or it's a special needs student, a special education student, or even just transportation funding. The differential between what it costs to transport kids in a school district in Metro Detroit versus the western end of the UP is night and day. And having a budget that takes that into account is important. Having a budget that makes sure that kids are fed, that kids can, that kids don't have to try to learn hungry, is important. So I do think there are things from a bipartisan standpoint that we're going to see both in this budget and as we go forward.
Historically, looking at the numbers here in Michigan on the number of students who are actually attending K-12 public education, since 2013-14, that number has just kind of slowly gone down, yet the amount of money we're spending on education is going up, 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 and Governor Whitmer will probably be signing another record education funding budget. Shouldn't these numbers be more together, where if the number of the students are going down, the amount of funding should be going down?
If we were adequately funding education from the outset of those numbers, you might be able to make that argument, but we weren't. Michigan was dead last in education funding increases over the last 25 years. The School Finance Research Consortium over the last several years has shown the thousands of dollars that we're underfunding just to get to a basic level of funding, let alone dealing with that additional funding that's needed for at-risk special education, English language learners, rural transportation funding. So there are real needs that we have to build in to our budget process going forward. And yes, a record education budget's likely going to get signed. It still isn't up to the adequacy that we need to make sure that every student's getting the education that we need to drive our economy forward. That's going to take more time and more discussion. Groups like Launch Michigan have had those discussions in terms of trying to move this forward. We really think and hope that the governor's commission around the future population growth of Michigan and investments and changes that need to be made in our education system to align to that gets to that and understands the fact that we have to put the resources in to get the outcomes that we want.
We recently were able to interview the leadership of a Detroit Academy school that made the commitment to offer and pay teachers $100,000 a year if they were accredited, if they had certain classroom performance standards. If they hit those, Is that something, if implemented statewide, that NEA would support?
You know, I think when we look at minimum salary, we've got to drive everybody up. There are far too many people. We're in the bottom 10 in the country in terms of average starting salary. It's still sub $40,000. So we've got work to do on this front, but there also we have to take into account the differences in terms of cost of living. The cost of living in Metro Detroit, especially in some areas and suburbs, is a heck of a lot different than in the UP or Northern Michigan. We've got to take everything into account. That's the beauty of being able to negotiate about these things locally, providing that funding, providing that resources so that school districts can work with their employees and figure out what do we need to bring the best and brightest educators for our students. That's the key. In general, we've got to lift everybody up. And that's going to have to happen at a district by district level.
When you think about young educators that are coming into the scene right now, I mean, how many of them are excited and interested in joining a union?
I think a lot are. I mean, when we look at the Gen Z folks coming in, there is a lot of passion for the power of being part of a collective organization that believes in public education. We've got a lot of work to do together to make sure that our schools are safe, that we've got the curriculum that we need, that we've got the funding that we need, that we've got the professional development that we need to help every student achieve success. So when we come together collectively, whether it's bargaining contracts, whether it's working collectively in a community, whether it's organizing around particular issues, whether it's just making sure that we've got good evaluation and professional support systems in place, that's what unions are about. And that's what people coming into the profession are looking for. But we still have way too many people who are coming into the profession and leaving within the first 5 years. This is a great and noble profession. It is something that people can do and make a difference over the course of time. And we want to make that case that it is a great place to build a life, to build a career, to build a calling, and be able to provide for a family, to be able to lead that middle-class existence and continue to improve yourself. So there's a lot that we can do together.
Doug, help our listeners out here with a little pronunciation. Your new incoming president, her name is Chandra
Matafari. Matafari. Chandra is a educator from Novi. She takes office in the middle of July. She's got a broad background in terms of leadership development, professional development, certainly engaging in kind of the more traditional union aspects in terms of membership, growth and bargaining, legislative, political action. So she's coming with a wealth of knowledge, and we're excited to get started.
What should listeners take away from the fact that the MEA changed its leadership and voted against Paula Herbert for another term?
That, you know, we are a democratic small D organization. We vote for our leaders. We vote for our budget. We vote for our dues. That, you know, this is an organization that over the years has changed. MEA has been around for 170 years. God willing, it's going to be around for 170 more. Just in my tenure, this is my fifth president that I'll be serving under. We've got work to do, and we're ready to do it.
So in other words, the membership at the MEA, they're not shy about changing directions if they feel like there needs to be directional change.
That's what democratic organizations are about, making, you know, I'm about to head to the NEA Representative Assembly, which is the world's largest democratically elected deliberative body. There's 8,000 delegates. You know, we are an organization that's responsive to our members, and we're proud of that.
I want to ask about the bill that allows for union dues to be taken out of a teacher's paycheck. What is the point of this? Because it almost seems like it's mainly about eliminating an administrative burden.
You know, when the ban on payroll deduction of dues was enacted in 2011, 2012, it was done in direct response to educators standing up and fighting for collective bargaining rights. It only applies to school employees. It only applies to the people who are dedicated to serving our students. It was an unfair bill when it was passed, and we're looking forward to it being part of a package of bills that go away. In the end, this is just like your United Way and Christmas Club and everything else that you do in terms of carving up your paycheck. Educators should have the same rights as everybody else, public and private sector, to, you know, pay their dues how they see fit.
As we're looking at other labor unions, whether it's the trades or the UAW, you're seeing more Republicans having success, more Republican candidates having success in connecting with those memberships. We haven't seen as much of that with the MEA. What is kind of the appeal if you're trying to get a Republican to support the payroll deduction bill or any of the other bills that you all are putting out there? What is the message to them to get them to cross over? Because we haven't really seen any Republicans cross over and support any of the bills that you all are in highly support of.
Well, like I talked about, as we go forward, I think there's a lot of things that are going to see bipartisan support that are going to be something that can truly embrace the concept that in the end, education, making sure our students get the education they deserve, should not be a partisan issue. You know, jumping in the Wayback Machine, going back to, you know, 2008, 2010, you know, that's really when the partisanship of this started. And we need to get back to embracing some of those things and working together. And groups like Launch Michigan are a great example in terms of working together. You know, MEA and Brian Kelly have been on opposite sides of plenty of things over the years, but we're together and working together with the business, the philanthropic community, in terms of making sure that we have the quality of public education that we need for our students. That's something that we can all get together on. And again, the working conditions of educators are the learning conditions of our students. They are tied together. And when we advocate for one, we're advocating for the other as well. And really, that's something that should be blind in terms of which side of the aisle you're on.
Doug Pratt, he's with the Michigan Education Association. We appreciate you taking some time and speaking to our listeners here on the MERS Monday podcast.
My pleasure.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. Also, thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Okay, we've heard everybody else's favorite Disney movies. John, what about yours?
It would be a tie, I think, between National Treasure and Remember the Titans.
Do we have a tie in these kind of things?
Well, if I had to pick, then I guess I would go with National Treasure because it's a little more fun than Remember the Titans, but... Man, Remember the Titans just tugs at your heartstrings.
I don't even think of those as Disney movies. I think I only think of the cartoons. Why is that?
I don't know. They have a lot of really good non-cartoon movies.
Sam, where are you going with this?
Oh my gosh. So I am just a typical Little Mermaid fan. I haven't seen the new Little Mermaid yet, but I love a little bit of underwater magic for sure. And I guess if we're going to talk about like other movies, if you think like Disney Channel movie, I love The 13th Year, which is about a boy who finds out when he turns 13 that he was actually a mermaid.
Isn't that a merman?
A merman. Correction. I apologize. He was a merman.
Oh, all right. So he didn't even change genders, too.
Careful there. You're gonna get in controversy here talking about.
Well, no. I mean, I'm just trying to clarify what was going on here because
I'm gonna divert. It was just it's a good movie. He was a competitive swimmer, and I was also a little bit of a swimmer back in the day. So, either way, 10 out of 10. If it has a mermaid in it, I love the movie.
Pull that up and watch it, man. I think I vaguely remember that movie.
I got to let the kids know. I bet you they'd love to watch that. I haven't watched a ton of Disney movies, The only one I can think of that I like is Alice in Wonderland, because I can't really quite figure out what's going on, and I kind of like that. Like, I feel like that there's some psychedelic trip that's going on here that I'm not
lost down the rabbit hole with Alice in Wonderland.
It's like the whole thing is like just a crazy dream, and after you're done, like, wow, that's like a dream I had last night. That's pretty wild.
And they have like the iconic Jefferson Airplane song that goes with it.
Yes, that's right. I love that Jefferson Airplane song. That's great. The White Rabbit. Actually, that's a good one to close on. All right, Mark, play that up. All right, here we go. In Your Head by Jefferson. Is that an airplane or a starship?
Jefferson Airplane.
Is that an airplane?
And then
all right.
Starship is like, Starship was the makeup band.
Yeah, okay. All right, I gotcha. There's our music trivia. All right. All right, I think that's a close then. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin for Samantha Schreiber and John Roering. Take care.